Welcome, everyone, to the 2020 United Way of Salt Lake Speaker Series, Building Equitable Communities. I wanted to take a minute before welcoming our guests, first to let you know that with regrets, Bill Krim is not able to be here tonight. He is fine, but not feeling well to be here. So I'm here instead. My name is Danya, and I work with him and the rest of the United Way of Salt Lake team. I'll next thank our generous sponsors for this year's event. We are so incredibly grateful to Salt Lake Community College for being this year's presenting sponsor. We are so grateful to AT&T and Chevron as our major sponsors, to Comcast as a supporting sponsor, and to Rocky Mountain Power as a community partner. This is our fourth year doing a speaker series on racial equity. It has long been the core work of United Way of Salt Lake to address the persistent and unacceptable inequities that exist in the education, health, and economic outcomes in our communities. It's long been our work to convene outcomes-focused cross-sector partnerships, and this event is an opportunity for us to first learn together and then to act together for racial equity. Do note that we have closed captioning available for this event. To access the live captioning in this Zoom room, you can select Show Subtitle on the Closed Caption or More menu. And then to view the full transcript, just visit the link that was sent to you in the chat box. It is now my pleasure to turn the time over to Denise Hufdelin, the president of Salt Lake Community College, for a few words. Denise and her amazing team have played integral roles in the Promise Partnership Regional Council, which is the coordinating body for all of our outcomes-focused partnerships for many, many years. She's also been visionary in Utah's work to make post-secondary education affordable and accessible to all Utahns. President Hufdelin, so glad to be here with you this evening.
Thank you, Danya. On behalf of all of my Salt Lake Community College colleagues, let me share how thrilled we are to be a partner with United Way in sponsoring this year's speaker series. The series really aims to take a deeper look at race and diversity in America, and each of our speakers has been chosen to share their unique expertise and perspective to illuminate truths, to inspire us to start conversations, and to create conversations for the complex issues facing our communities. At Salt Lake Community College, we are continuing and perhaps amplifying our work related to inclusion and racial justice by looking at our own systems that might be perpetuating systemic racism. If you know the history of higher education, you know it is a history built on exclusion. The first colleges were accessible only to wealthy white men. And it wasn't until the Truman Commission in 1946 that college access was considered important and worthy of new institutions with open access missions and worthy of dedicated federal funds to close the very, very deep financial gaps. So our mission at SLCC is inextricably tied to the educational attainment of those in Salt Lake County, the most racially and ethnically diverse county in the state. And we are currently not meeting our goals as they relate to access and completion. So identifying those barriers that we have constructed that have led to that completion gap and having the courage to name and dismantle them has become for us a key imperative. At the beginning of every academic year, I choose a quote to guide our thinking and to perhaps frame the year. And this year's quote I chose was from the late Congressman John Lewis. And his quote was, "You must be bold, brave, and courageous, and find a way to get in the way." I am very proud to be leading an institution that is willing to be courageous, but I'm also very clear that we can do little by ourselves. So that's why I'm thrilled, and my colleagues at SLCC are thrilled tonight to listen to Dr. McAfee and his ideas. It is clear that as a leader at PolicyLink, he is taking bold and brave steps to lift up what works and to create, as their mission states, groundbreaking policy changes that enable everyone, especially people of color, to be economically secure, live in healthy communities of opportunity, and benefit from a just society. If you've not been on their website and read their equity manifesto, I encourage you to do so. I did it myself this afternoon, and I am finding ways to adopt it in our own organizational work. I invite you to do the same. So a few housekeeping items for the Q&A portion of the event. We encourage you to use the Q&A submission box in the Zoom webinar for any questions that you might have for Dr. McAfee. And then a few of those questions will be chosen and we'll begin to have conversation between Danya and Dr. McAfee about those around 4:40 p.m. After this event, we will have a networking reception in a separate Zoom meeting to meet and discuss what we learned from Dr. McAfee. And if you signed up for that reception, we hope that you have received an email with that link. I will now turn the time back to Danya from the United Way team and Dr. McAfee. Thanks so much for being with us.
President Hufteland, thank you so much for those remarks and getting us started here. And Dr. McAfee, thank you so much for it's a pleasure to be here with you.
Likewise.
Thank you. To get us started, can you tell us a bit about yourself, about the work of PolicyLink, and about what drew you to this work that you do with PolicyLink?
Sure. I'll start with what drew me to this work. I come out of the Midwest, being raised in Kansas City, Missouri, and grew up, fishing and hunting, all that, playing outside. That was my life. But my parents were always service oriented. My dad in the military, career in the military. My mother, a registered nurse. And in the 70s, when, busing came about, my parents didn't want me to get caught up in the hostility that was being projected at kids being bused. So they sent me to private school. So I got to live in kind of both worlds, the world of working class family struggling to make ends meet, but certainly not enough to send me to private school, but figured out a way to do it. And so I got to clearly begin to see these different worlds of opportunity. And that really formed the foundation of me wanting to do this work, seeing it in my home, seeing it in my community of faith, and then the getting that LaSallian education and ultimately being inspired by some Jesuit priests. That it formed the underpinnings of me wanting to do this work. My actual first service, I would say, started with me spending 8 years in the military. That was my path out of poverty, trying to figure out what to do and really enjoyed that. And then I went on to run a youth, work at a community foundation to help wealthy donors figure out how they can make charitable investments, to working in the nonprofit sector, to working at the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development for 11 years. And then finally, over the last 10, coming to PolicyLink. And if you were to say, what's been the arc of that journey? I've been chasing one thing, to really the impact that is needed to make opportunity less random in this country for everyone. And so with each move, it was because of my dissatisfaction with the level of impact that I could have from where I was sitting and trying to find additional ways to be a results-based leader. And that journey has then now brought me to being the president and CEO of PolicyLink for the last 2 years.
I so appreciate your point about the multiple ways that you've had opportunity to make impact. I think the work that PolicyLink does is so unique. Could you just say a little bit more about the specific way that PolicyLink is working to affect social change?
Absolutely. PolicyLink started. When you think about the concept of equity or racial equity, PolicyLink started that concept. Angela Glover Blackwell, with a host of others, started that concept 20 years ago when even Black people said, oh, you shouldn't talk about equity, you shouldn't talk about racial equity. But Angela believed something that was quite powerful that I still believe holds true today. She said, Michael, sometimes you have to introduce a concept to the world and then create the space for the world to grow into that concept. And that's what PolicyLink has really been, a space creator for folks to find their way to wanting to advance racial and economic justice in this this society. And our job is a quite unique one. We're one of the top think tanks in the country. And if you were to say, what's one of our differentiators? We believe that we do our best work when we're actually working alongside folks in community and we're lifting up what works. We're taking their voice, wisdom, and experience and translating that into public policy. And during the Obama years, you know, we had an amazing run of being able to help President Obama design promised neighborhoods, choice neighborhoods, sustainable communities, healthy food financing initiative, and promise zones. So the work at PolicyLink is to create public policy, to design a world that is just and fair. Some days that may have you in the White House. Some days it has you in community, whether they're rural communities, urban or suburban communities, working on solutions, to sometimes in the state houses where we've been busy passing tenant protection bills, police use of force bills, et cetera. So that is our job. It's one part, I would say, management consulting shop, one part policy shop, one part trying to have a leadership voice that can help be the conscience of the nation around these issues, and the other a thought leader.
You mentioned Promise Neighborhoods, which was started by the Obama administration and which provides the basis for so much of our work here locally through the Promise Partnership. I wonder if you could say a little bit more about that, talk a little bit about what civic infrastructure is and why civic infrastructure is important and why you think partnerships.
Yeah, well, you know, Promise Neighborhoods was designed by PolicyLink, modeled after the Harlem Children's Zone. Jeff Canada serves on the PolicyLink board. He's my board member. And it was a recognition of an evolution of learning how to really provide good supports for children and their families. Over the last 40 years, we've gotten really good at knowing what children and families need, but there was still something missing. And that one thing was this notion of holding that cradle to career continuum. So often we could do really good work, say 0 to 5, do good prenatal work, postnatal work, end up doing a lot around managing toxic stress. And then we forget about the kids when they go to middle school. Or we'll do really good work in the middle school years, help them make a transition from elementary to middle, and then we forget about them in high school. Or we get them through high school and then we don't really have them set up to be successful, whether they want to go to a trade, go to college, or do something else. And so the question became, how do you hold a system together so a child can have a pathway out of poverty that is consistent and steady, even as the things around them may not be that way? That was the essence of Promise Neighborhoods. And that work is still important because when you look around the country, no matter what city you're in, the scale of the problem is too significant for charity approaches to be enough. And when I talk about charity approaches, I'm not talking about charity in a negative way. Charity is needed. It provides momentary relief. But if you want to earn the right to expect that for money expended, things have gotten better, something else is needed. And this is why the way the folks in Salt Lake have taken up collective impact work, thinking about systemic and integrated approaches to children and families has been so key. Because that is truly how you get to scale. That is really how you have the transformative and lasting impact that communities need to have around this country if we're going to stay a strong nation.
Mm-hmm. What else have you learned about what it takes for partnerships like this that do full cradle to career work, that work on programming, but also look to scale and create policy change? What have you learned about the characteristics of those partnerships?
Well, it started with something that Denise said early. It's about accountability. Everything starts with accountability, where you can be humble enough to just admit when you've not hit your marks and still have the commitment to continue to figure out. We're all learning how to do this work. So not hitting a mark is not something to beat ourselves up about. It's tough work. The question is, do we have the right culture of accountability where we can learn how to get better and improve? That's the first thing that I've learned. And Salt Lake City has been leading the way in creating the conditions for partners to come together and have accountability conversations. That's the first thing. Without accountability, this is all wasted effort. Mm-hmm. The second is to be clear about who you serve and so that you can craft good strategy. If you can't hold the population in mind, it's hard to craft good strategy. What I mean by that is this. If you walk into any city, they should be able to tell you the number of any initiative. We're talking about 300 kids, 2 kids, 5,000 families. What are we talking about? Because if you're not holding the same mental map of that number, what's your number? Then strategy gets off base really quickly, right? And so the second thing that I've learned is outside of accountability, you get to operationalizing accountability. by being clear and disciplined about strategy setting that comes out of understanding the population, setting a result, setting some measures of progress, and then beginning to think about why those indicators are trending in a particular way. And then the third thing that we've learned is that it's important to craft the right mix of solutions. And this is why I'm so excited about your work. You're not just trying to do programmatic stuff. That is important. But you're holding the right mix of solutions given whatever scenario is appropriate. When I talk about the right mix of solutions, we're talking about families owning the contribution for improving their own lives and the lives of their children, high quality programs and services, and or sometimes we've got to implement systems changes or policy solutions to get to where we want to go in terms of the impact that we want to have at scale. So those are the things, the culture of accountability that gets created, the discipline to craft rigorous strategy that is informed by data, and then the ability to craft the right mix of solutions that give you a fighting chance to make progress.
Mm-hmm. So well said, thank you. I'd love to spend a little bit more time on the idea of knowing your numbers. When I first got to know your work many, many years ago, I heard that expression. It's an expression that's taken hold among a lot of the partners that I have the opportunity to work with. Will you say a little bit more about what it means to know your numbers? And then how, like right now, you're grappling with the fact that there's bias embedded in some of the ways that we've measured our numbers, and how you think about the opportunity to use different types of numbers, to know different numbers, to create the equitable conditions we need.
Well, this is where I just use my good old Midwestern street smarts and common sense. Let's start nationally for a moment, because this is really important, because it's going to go right down to the local. Nationally, my number at PolicyLink is 100 million plus. There's more than 100 million people in America, 25% of whom are white, living at 200% of poverty. So it's important to hold that number, because right now everybody's having a racial awakening. And some, like last week, a couple of banks came to us and said, we want to start a racial wealth gap initiative. And they were getting ready to go and do a program. And we said, stop for a moment. Really excited you want to do this work, but let's get disciplined about how we're going to do this. It's 100 million folks. That's 1 in 3 folks who are economically insecure in America. So what are we talking about? Are you talking about doing something in Tennessee, Texas, a city, a county, a region, a state, the country? You see, right off the bat, if you're not owning a number, you jump in and say, hey, let's just do anything. Anything won't get you there. So the first clarity that we were asking them to say is, tell us who you want to serve and where. Now, they've got some of the best consulting shops in the country in this meeting, and they've not started there. They've already cooked up an effort that they want to do. And think about it. What I was saying to this, I'm going to save you money, because your effort will not work. Your effort won't work because the scale of the problem is so significant. And this is important, because the racial wealth gap gets you to some of the root cause analysis that you all have been doing really well. The racial wealth gap was caused by design. It wasn't caused because people don't want to work. It was caused because people have had a 400-year head start. You designed a society where you intentionally said, you know what? We're going to have a hierarchy of human value, and some folks will not be allowed to participate in it. Denise signaled that around education, but the same thing happened around housing, criminal justice, et cetera. And even today in this racial awakening, people will often say, well, you know, that was years ago. Why don't we just let it go? That's true. And many of those institutions are still causing harm today. And a really good example is if you look at our own U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, on one side of the house, it puts billions of dollars out for community development and improvement. And then on the other side of the house, it just said, you know what, we're going to get rid of the law that would prevent housing discrimination, right? And so you can see these disconnects. So when you know your number, you're able to begin to think about how would you enter a conversation around the racial wealth gap? It's talking about doing work in Tennessee is very different than talking about doing work in Nashville, which is very different than talking about doing work across the country. And that discipline then allows us to think about whether we want to be ideologues or not. I often say the political spectrum is useless when it comes to results. And this is what's holding our nation hostage right now. We are so wedded to ideological perspectives on the left and the right and in the middle that actually have nothing to do with helping people, which is what they need. And so if you want to solve the racial wealth gap, this is probably the fourth thing that I've learned in collaborations. The question is, do you want to do the work that is required, or do you want to make a point? Very different things. If you want to be an ideologue, you don't have to be accountable to anybody. And you see that all day long. You see it right now. Those of us who have the luxury are arguing ideologically, while the nation can't even seem to find its way to give people $300 to keep them in their homes. And think about the tragedy of this. You got millions of people who are about to be evicted for no fault of their own because the government said shut down. Now, what would be cheaper, keeping them in their homes or trying to get them rehoused after they've blown their credit? They've got a bad mark from a landlord who doesn't want to rent from them anymore. Now you've created a host of other problems. So knowing your number gives you a sense, a chance to aspire to doing the transformative work that is necessary, or deciding to do something that is very focused, but maybe at a smaller scale, but that can be equally as transformative if done right. Is that helpful?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You mentioned PM through three work a couple of minutes ago, and everything you just said just got me thinking about the traditional measures that we've used to that we've held ourselves accountable to in this mm-hmm. cradle to career work. And I wonder how you're thinking right now about some of those traditional measures of kindergarten readiness, third grade reading, post-secondary access, sort of as the numbers we should know and the outcomes we should be working on.
I think like around the kindergarten work, I think this is a place where we are pros. We have some of the best evidence about what to measure. But the bigger problem for us right now is to think about the community context that is undercutting our numbers. And this is what I want any of the donors on the call to think about today. There is so much going on in the communities that are undercutting the good work of your investment and the good work of the nonprofit sector. I'm going to give you a couple of examples. Let's take Flint, Michigan. We've known that the water is poisoning kids for now over 2 or 3 years. And we've chosen not to pass a bond measure to fix the pipes like we would do in my neighborhood. We still now high five because we can pass out water bottles like this is a third world country. But what's happening is kids are still taking showers and they're still being poisoned by that lead. So what does that mean? That means that you've just forfeited the right to ask, how are these kids doing in the first grade, second grade, third grade, fourth grade, fifth grade, because we know how lead impacts development. You see my point? And so this is a real world example where if you don't craft good strategy, you never solve the problem. So you might feel good about passing out water bottles, and that was really important, but it doesn't earn you the right to expect that outcomes down the road will be better for kids. And that is the problem right there, that this nation has this hierarchy of human value that says for those poor kids, water bottles are fine. If that was my neighborhood, we would have demanded. We wouldn't have even had to demand too hard to go on and just tear the streets up and replace the pipes. It would have been done. But this is happening all over our country, whether it's a poor white community, a poor Native American community, a poor Asian community, a poor Black community, a poor Latinx community. We are creating a toxic stew in our communities that the good work that we try to advance can't overcome. That's one example. I gave you another one around how HUD is dismantling the Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing Rule, which is basically saying it's a field day on discrimination. And so these things are real and they are oppressive. Think about what our federal government just did around immigration. Dislocated more than 500 kids from their families. Our institutions can't be working against us as we're trying to do good work to help our communities. That's what we've got to stop. The harm that our institutions are doing so that our good work can take root and flourish. But as long as you have hostile institutions that fundamentally don't care about poor people in substantive ways, it's hard to get the results we want. I'll give you the last example when Mike Brown got killed. For years, folks have been doing an amazing job helping people get checking accounts, to get banked, to get their credit scores up so that they can move into a home, do the things that they want to do with their lives, even get a job. And you discover that municipalities have made these agreements that, you know what, we will finance ourselves off of the back of poor communities because we need revenue. So instead of raising taxes in a fair way, we'll just over-police communities that can't afford legal counsel. And a $30 ticket becomes a $1,000 ticket, becomes a $5,000 ticket. So while we're over here building, trying to build wealth, the municipality in Ferguson, Missouri had said, I see these people as a revenue stream. I don't see their humanity. I see them as a revenue stream. And you and I both know that if you over-policed our kids like that, we would shut the police department down. You know what I mean? It wouldn't even be allowed to exist. And so this is what I mean about institutions in our nation now having to figure out, do they want to serve? Because we're holding our results hostage. When I say results, I'm talking about creating a society in which everyone can participate, prosper, and reach their full potential. And we can get there. This whole awakening right now is really about, who do we want to be as a nation? This democracy has always been an experiment. It continues to be an experiment. And our job is, do we want to participate in that experiment? Or do we want to simply get mad at folks who don't share our perspective, but are nonetheless wholeheartedly participating in shaping this society the way they want it to be shaped? That's the conundrum before us. And what you hear me laying out are some ways in which we've got to decide to want to shape this society. The first is to make our governments be what we need them to be and to stop causing harm. The second is for civil society to actually be able to be more impactful in its work, which we're learning to do. And the third now is for corporations to begin to use their power influence, as they're starting to actually help us do this work better.
Yeah. So powerful. Thank you. Are there stories you can tell? Are there examples you could offer us of how that's starting to take shape, or how that's happened in other communities?
Yeah. Let me tell you a couple of corporate stories that I think are just, I couldn't have even dreamed that I would see this in my lifetime. I could tell you a major retailer. If I said their name, you'd easily know them. Probably one of the top five, really in the top two. Beginning to think about, you know what? Democracy is important to us. It's a tragedy to see our grandparents and our mothers and fathers having to stand in line for 7, 8, 10, 11 hours in the United States to vote. We were talking to them, we said, you know, you don't need to put your money in racial equity right now. Put your leadership voice in racial equity. Imagine if you took your political action committee money and said to electeds, no one gets our money if you're doing anything to encumber people's ability to vote. Think about how powerful that is. It would send ripples through electeds. It would make them overnight change their behavior because corporations have that ability. And so that is a real world example where a corporation is trying to figure that out right now. We're seeing corporations agree to pay their workers above the minimum wage in some significant ways to make sure that they have a living wage according to what it costs to live in that particular region. You do that, you need less charity, right? These are huge steps forward. We're seeing people beginning to say, you know what, we're gonna get consistent hours for workers so that they can know how when they got to work this week so that they can plan their lives around all these things that we take for granted. We're going to create portable benefits packages because we know more and more workers aren't going to stay on jobs for 20 years. So how can they take that benefits package with them? We see firm companies like Prudential beginning to think about that and creating those types of financial supports so people can, those portable financial supports, so that people can have those things that springboard you into the middle class. Those are real world examples. When it comes to government, we're seeing a lot of governments around the country say, you know what, we are going to be anti-racist. They're starting to look at their institutions and say, where are we hurting people? And how do we begin to stop it? Because a lot of this harm can be stopped by the leader choosing to compel it to be so. We're already authorized. Those of us who are in the CEO positions, we're already authorized to do their jobs. There's not much that people tell me to do or don't do, right? I can actually choose to pay my staff fairly. I can actually choose to make sure my salary is no more than 5 times the lowest person. I can make sure the lowest person actually makes a living wage in this region here. I can do all those things. I can find white folks and Native Americans and indigenous folks. No one has to authorize me to do that. I have so much power, even though it may not feel like it most days, to create the world that I want to see, starting with my own organization. And so when you think about the power of police departments, health departments, universities, et cetera, our CEOs have the capability to usher in and accelerate equity in ways that we never imagined, if they would simply see themselves as that renewing agent of change that is not only going to renew their institution, but is going to renew our democracy as well.
Mm-hmm. Wow. You've written so powerfully about the roles that corporations can play in this moment, and mm-hmm. and the roles that CEOs can provide as well. And you've just provided us some really concrete actions for the private sector and for CEOs. I wonder if there are any more that that come to mind.
Yeah, you know, the thing that we are talking to CEOs about, they're not fully there yet, is this. The first is, can we get honest about our origin story as a nation so we can then heal and move on? Because when you get that consciousness about something that is real and a harm that has been done, you can then get the consciousness to want to do something about it. But when you've raised generations of people who don't even know the history of this nation, really, it's hard to get on the same page. And I say that because when you read books like Dying of Whiteness, you see the things that were set in motion for Black and Brown folks to deny opportunity are starting to really negatively impact white Americans right now. That's why I signal 25% of that 100 million is white. And a practical example is right here in the Bay. You know, if you read The Color of Law, you'll see how public education systems out here decided to break up. This is why you got all these governing jurisdictions and locales, because they didn't want to be next to those people back in the day. And so now you got all these small school districts popped up. But in the process of doing that, education, we ceded it as a public good and we ceded the quality of it. So now as our downtowns are coming back, a white family with a child has to make a decision. Can I afford my rent or my mortgage and private school? Because you're sitting there and saying, you know, public school is not that great. And I want my child to have a good education, a good start in life. This is an example of something where someone may say, yeah, I had nothing to do with that, which is absolutely true. But not resolving it means now our evolution has finally caught up with that sin. Mm-hmm. And now it is sweeping up a whole bunch of folks. Another example, I'm giving you some reverse examples so that you can see how radically imaginative people are. So then you can think about how radically imaginative we have to be to actually create the world we want to create. Take Florida as an example. If you read a lot of the literature, you'll see Florida designed its unemployment system to not work. Its unemployment insurance system to not work. Think about that. So the first thing is you're going to use taxpayer dollars. You're going to waste them to create a system that doesn't even serve the taxpayer. Think about that. But you did it because of that Black welfare queen racist trope that you're able to get by with. And who would have thunk that those middle class Black and Brown and Latinx and Asian folks, those small business owners, would have hit a pandemic where they needed to access that system. And so now in places like Florida and California, folks are still waiting to get their unemployment checks, to get a lifeline, because this is what happens when you build systems on that hierarchy of human value. You build them to be inefficient and ineffective. And all around our country, you've got examples of this. Systems that you and I would never, ever, ever use. We would never use them. And if they were in the private sector, they'd be shut down because the market would give you that feedback. But yet these systems are allowed to endure and people are suffering. And these are real ways in which now systems designed to hurt Black people are now hurting white folks in large numbers. And I'm signaling that because sometimes in our sector, we'll say, well, you know, we got to start small. We got to go slow. Designing a system to not work is results at scale. It wasn't designed for a part of Florida. It was designed for all of Florida. That's transformative. That's transformative. It's radically imaginative. It's just toxic. Coming up with the system to create 20, 30 jurisdictions so your kids can have your own little private school district, radically imaginative. You go to places like Illinois and California, you see all these little governing jurisdictions. This is why it's so hard to collaborate regionally when it comes time to do things like transportation, as an example, because you have to get all of these jurisdictions to want to get on board. Now, why do you have all those jurisdictions? You have all of those jurisdictions because they didn't want to be next to people like me. And now folks who need transportation to get down to Silicon Valley because they live in San Francisco, et cetera, don't have an efficient way to do that, which then further exacerbates our climate challenges, right? So you can begin to see the ripple effects of us allowing these systems to stand. The good news is places like Salt Lake City and others are making progress. You're starting to see systems and you're starting to make the improvements that are necessary while still getting those really good programmatic outcomes for children and families. And this is why I'm hopeful. Because at a very time where you have so much intensity on both sides, good and bad, about what's happening, there's these bastions of hope and promise in places like Salt Lake City, Utah, where you've been doing the work for years, you're stepping into the work. It's a place that's doing some of the most innovative work, and folks wouldn't even probably think that. But I get to see it because of my role all the time. And that's what keeps me very hopeful, is that in spite of the difficulties, in spite of us having a lot of tough work to do to transform our institutions, I'm seeing folks like the folks at the United Way and in your stakeholder groups who are up to the task. And even what I'm more excited about is that these are multiracial coalitions who are coming to this work in ways that we probably never imagined would happen. So we are really on the precipice of winning on equity in a beautiful way. Whether that's going to be 1 year or 50 more, we are on the way. And that's why I stay in this work. And that's why I'm still excited, even though this is a really tough, toxic time.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to stick on the equity concept for a moment. You've talked about equity and the worry that I think many of us share that it becomes a buzzword, that it gets watered down. It stops having the meaning that it should have. So what do you mean by that? And what do you think are the antidotes to having it be something that is still measurable and results focused?
Yeah, I would say equity has gotten watered down, and that's okay. You know, things happen, but the reality is there's always a few who continue to be the standard bearers and keep holding the flame and keep it held high, even in the ebbs and flows of society. It's gotten watered down because everybody wants to put these words in their strategy documents, but few want to say, what does it mean for us? What would it mean for us to take on structural racism? If you put that word in a strategy document, you ought to know what the hell it means. You can't say that and then tell me you don't believe in structural racism, or you think that we've gotten past it. You see, these things are disconnects that are huge that are in our world. You can't tell me you're going to put structural racism in your document and then tell me you can't actually see the harm that our institutions are doing today. I spent 8 years in the military. The military is not perfect. Same way police forces aren't perfect. There's no institution that's perfect. PolicyLink isn't perfect. So this is what I mean when I say, when you can't get honest about who we are and what we need to improve, you just become an ideologue. And that's what's holding us back right now. So the thing is, we've got to be clear about what equity means for us. Equity for PolicyLink, in the definition that we use, is about creating a just and fair society in which all can participate, prosper, and reach their full potential. And there are a couple of words that are key in there: justice, fairness, and all. So in this Black Lives Matter moment, people are not saying we don't care about white folks. You cannot do this work and not care about all. What we're saying is, if you can solve for the anti-blackness that is contaminating everybody in this nation, you end up helping everybody. That's why I use these examples to show you how anti-black racism caused those systems to be created now that are sweeping up blacks and whites and all sorts of folks. And so equity has to be about the design of the nation. But equity also has to start with our own institutions, because you can't, it's, I don't know how you lead on stuff that you don't struggle with yourself. And so I understand how hard equity is, because I got a 70-person shop that looks like the United Nations, and trying to manage all that energy, all those different views, it's tough. But man, when it works, it is a beautiful thing. And that's why Policy Link is successful, because it is hard. But man, the ideas and the impact that we have could have never been generated if it was just people that look like me. And so equity has to be about a commitment to these things, not about making cases anymore. See, women shouldn't have to wait till Michael McAfee gets it to be paid equitably. The LGBTQ community shouldn't have to wait till I get it to feel safe at work and feel like the community supports them. We're beyond centering patriarchy, whiteness, blackness, whatever you want to call it. Because when you do that, you're making a huge assumption. And that assumption is that while the work is being held hostage, you're assuming that someone even cares enough to be thinking about wanting to be enlightened, wanting to have a change of heart. And I'm signaling that right now, because so often when you talk about equity in organizations, people will say things like, oh, my board, they're not ready for that. That might be true, but you need to get honest to them about then all the results that are going to be held hostage. See, you can, we don't have to do equity work, but we also don't have to do results-based work either, because they're one and the same. You see my point? So don't tell me you're going to talk about results and then tell me you're not going to talk about equity. It goes back to that accountability. If it takes me a year to find a Native American person to put on my board, I should be fired. If it takes me a year to find, or five, to find a woman to put on my board, I should be fired. If I can't find a diverse workforce, especially in a diverse executive team, I should be fired. Because here's what I do know. There are people out there who do know how to do it. The talent's there. And so if I don't want to do those things, I don't have to do them. I just should get out of this seat, because this seat requires me to show up in a particular way and to deliver in a particular way. And until leaders get that point, you can never really fully internalize equity. And I'll give you some real ways where it gets tough. There was a moment when we were centering the 100 million at PolicyLink. And some of the staff said, you know, since we've never really focused on Black folks, are we just going to focus on Black folks as a part of that 100 million right now? And it just caused me to be so incensed, because I was like, really, this is where we've come to now. We're going to model the same oppressive behavior back that has been brought upon us. And we think that that's a forward-facing view for the nation. And to have to say, you know what? I don't even care about your point of view on this, because that's not what we're going to do. And you're welcome to leave if you like. That's the work of equity right there. It wasn't even going to be a conversation. Of course we're going to help white people. Of course we're going to help Native Americans. That all is real. And I'm signaling that because nobody gets off the hook simply because of their skin color. I've still got my own equity journey to do as an African American. I still have to do that work. I still have to get it right at PolicyLink, and we don't have it all right. But what you really hear me signaling is, when I'm committed to the journey, I can start finding all sorts of solutions and people to join with me to get there. So if anything you hear me saying is that equity starts with the leader taking it up. Equity starts with us having a structural mindset about how to improve society. Mm-hmm. And then lastly, it starts with the first line in the Equity Manifesto, where it says it begins by joining. You humbly begin to join with others, you'll change the world.
Yeah. I have so many other questions I want to ask you, but I'm going to go to the audience's question, because there are some really, really powerful ones here. I do just want to thank you for lifting up the idea of the need to focus equity work internally in our institutions at the same time that if we work in partnership settings, we look to do it externally as well.
No problem.
Okay, first question. This is a question about the Cradle to Career movement. How do community members, like providers and residents and parents, other individuals, engage with this movement when it is a collective strategy that's usually implemented by an agency? Is it possible to be part of a collective impact when we don't know the gatekeepers?
Yes, it is. It's a great question, because what that question usually suggests is that the leaders of the collective impact effort have not figured out how to tap the genius of community. I often say, you know, if you're crafting good strategy, you don't start with the nonprofits, you start with the people. I don't know how you improve third grade reading scores without getting parents involved. You see my point? And so if you started asking them, and I'll give you a practical example, San Antonio, Texas did this. You know, they say, hey, we're not going to start with nonprofits telling us what to do. We're going to go and talk to the parents and then organize the nonprofits to support the parents. And the culture of accountability that they created was to say, look, here's a calendar. Just put a sticker on the date every day that you read to your child. And when you come to the community meeting, bring your calendar and simply tell us one thing. What do you need help with to get better at reading to your child? That was a beautiful place to start, because then the nonprofits could listen and figure out who in this group really needs help, and let's help those folks. Others may not need it just yet. And so when you hear that question, collective impact is about everyone owning a contribution for a result. And our job has to be to have a commitment to extract those contributions. Contribution is not just showing up to a darn community meeting. And that's why I'm giving you this way in which San Antonio, Texas was able to have community members come and to come with their head held high and begin to talk about their contribution to a result. And that's how the meeting started, right there. So when you have these disconnects, it is a structural problem that we haven't fully gotten people. We haven't really called for people's contribution. And this is an important point, because if you don't have people's contribution in the room, and you let them come into the room, they're going to act out. And so every person you bring into the room who does not have a contribution that they're offering up becomes another personality for you to manage. And that becomes a nightmare, because before you know it, the work is not what sets front and center. Managing the politics of personalities is.
Yeah, thank you. The next question starts with a James Baldwin quote. James Baldwin says, "I can't believe what you say because I see what you do." Mm-hmm. So often we talk about systems work and systems change without being willing to make change in ourselves or our privilege. If you can't change the systems without upsetting the balance of power, how do you convince those in power, those who historically benefit and might love charity work, to actually care about systems change work?
This is probably one of the questions that I struggle with the most right now. And where I've come down on it, it may not be right. It's just where I'm at in my journey. I'm through convincing people of anything. I'm going to do the work myself. And I'm going to join with the others who want to do the work. Because I think racism and anti-Black racism is so deep in this country, I could spend a lifetime trying to convince somebody who doesn't care, because they don't even see my humanity, right? And so me trying to do that is, I just find it, when I'm on my deathbed, I do not want to say I spent my lifetime trying to convince people who didn't give a damn about me to care. That's not where I'm going to be. And that's a tough place to be right now, but it's tough because I have seen it firsthand. I have experienced it where, you know, folks treat you in some of the most egregious ways because they don't want to do this work. And yet they are gatekeepers and they're holding things up. But what I have found is this, you know, when you unleash your God-given gifts, people can't stop it. They can't stop it. They can cause you a little inconvenience, but they can't stop it. And the more I step into that belief, the more I'm able to have more impact. The more I'm able to find other souls who want to join and do more work. So that's how I choose to take it up. I'm out of the convincing business. Now, it doesn't mean that I'm not going to make sure you've got rigorous data and things like that that I can always share with you, like if you go to our website, et cetera. But I'm in the business of getting results for everybody in this nation. That's what I'm in the business to do. And that's where I'm going to spend my time.
PolicyLink has spoken about the value of integrating a curb cut effect paradigm into systems design. Can you share in your work an example on implementing a curb cut effect? Can you describe what it is, and can you talk about how it's led to a change?
Yeah, you know, the curb cut effect feeds nicely into the question that was just asked about how do you convince people to come along, which the curb cut was an example of trying to bring that to life for folks to say, you know, when you focus on the most vulnerable, it has cascading benefits to everybody else. That's the general theory. That curb cut in the street that was born out of Berkeley, California, for folks who were in wheelchairs or needing some type of easier access to the sidewalk is the curb cut. But today, think about how many of us use that curb cut. When I'm traveling all over the country, I look for that curb cut to make it easy to get my luggage up over the curb. Think about UPS and FedEx and those dollies. It makes it easier for them to get those packages up on that curb. That was designed for someone who we would consider the most vulnerable. They just were different, had different abilities. And now we all get to access it and benefit from it. There are other things like that that have been powerful as we've thought about building the middle class in this country. The GI Bill is another example. Coming back from World War II, investing in our soldiers, you built the white middle class. Even though we weren't able to participate in it, but eventually we did, we're able to. It helped move Black folks into the middle class as well when we were able to begin to participate in it. FHA is another one. Beginning to guarantee mortgages so that the white middle class could buy homes, built the white middle class. And what you see me signaling at a moment where we are now locked in an ideological battle that makes no sense is for the very folks who would say we should be evidence-based and you would talk about mobility and what works. What we know works is really good government investment in public policies that are effective. And those are two examples of where public policy built the white middle class, FHA, GI Bill. Mm-hmm. And today what we say is government, we don't have any money, but we want charity to do all of this. It's out of whack. That's not gonna happen. Mm-hmm. And the reality is this, it's magical that for dysfunction, we can find trillions of dollars. Isn't it amazing? To me, if you're broke, you're broke. You just don't have any money, pandemic or no pandemic. You don't have any money. It's fascinating. We can find trillions of dollars in a pandemic and not even deploy it effectively, for God's sake. And yet when it comes to anything that would be healthy, we don't have any money. Think about the tragedy of that. This is what I mean by creating a culture of accountability. It starts... It has to be in all of our institutions, folks. And this is an example where ideology won't save you. Because I don't think the white middle class back in the 40s and 50s and 60s were saying, no, government shouldn't help us out. Now, we've totally inverted this to where, you know, we almost can't do anything in a healthy way for our citizens in this country, whether you're Black, white, or whatever. And it's really tragic that we can't get healthcare, even though we see now in a pandemic how even those who we thought didn't need, we could care less about, oh, how they need it because they're our frontline workers, right? They need to be taken care of. So that curb cut, focus on those most in need, cascading benefits to everyone. I'm giving you some examples of where it was done in the past, and it really worked for all of us and ultimately even helped those of us of color move into the middle class and beyond. But it's just another example of a one-way possibility to help people think about something that they could already do, which is, I can care for folks without turning it into an intellectual argument. This is why I started with how I was raised, watching my mother and father care for people. some of these concepts are just good old fashioned, good old ways of living. And you should, it shouldn't take all these fancy ass frameworks to compel you to see someone's humanity, right? Especially when you see what's happening around us in society. And so that's why I say, even with the curb cut, I feel like we should always do that work. It's just not the work that I'm going to be doing going forward. Because I don't know how much people listen to it.
Wow. I almost don't have time to ask you one more question, but I'm going to do it anyway. What is the, what call to action would you leave us with?
Well, the call to action I would leave us with today is to say, I want you to think at the highest level, what do you want this nation to be? We should not be so arrogant to believe that our nation can't suffer demise of so many nations that were fueled off of hubris and greed. And when you decide what type of nation you want us to be, think about, does it include everyone? And if it does include everyone, think about what needs to be changed in our structures so that that can happen. And then set about doing that work. You know, I want white America to be as successful as anyone else. And my heart has to be there if this nation is going to be something different. And so the call to action is us really to think about what would a just and fair society look like structurally, and let's go get it. Let's go get it. And let's get off of this political spectrum arguing against ourselves. We're dealing against ourselves. And the beauty is we're going to lose if we don't solve this problem, regardless of your ideological perspective. The only thing we don't know is when we're going to lose. So that would be my call to action. Try to realize the promise of equity from right where you sit. Start with your own personal transformation and then join with others. We'll create a stronger nation.
Thank you so much for all of these reflections, for all of these examples, for all that you do for our world and for our country and for our community here in Salt Lake. We have a lot more to do as a partnership, but I want to lift up one thing you're saying, which is that we have an amazing partnership here, amazing partners, and there's so much potential to create the results that we're capable of.
I just want to say on this point, this is actually why I chose to do this today, because you all are doing some of the leading edge work in the country. So I just want to applaud you. You know, a lot of folks got cradle to career money, and after the money was gone, they stopped doing the work. But you all have stayed fast and holding true to doing the work. So just kudos to all the folks in Salt Lake City who are doing the right work.
We are going to end this portion of the event. Some of us will be moving on into some small group discussions. We'll have more of an opportunity to think about what it looks like to continue this work, to sustain it, to create the kind of transformative changes that you're challenging and inspiring us to look toward today. So thank you again for this time. Thank you everyone who's joined us, and have an excellent evening.
Take care, everyone.